This is Neighbors on Northland Morning.
Together we will stand, light and we'll fall. Come on now, people, let's get on the ball and work together. Come on, let's work together.
Do it, children.
Now, people, say now, together we will stand. Every boy, girl, woman, and man.
It's Neighbors on KUMD. An opportunity to share our concerns, our thoughts, our problem solving, check in with some experts, ask some questions, find out what's going on as we try to take good care of one another during these interesting times. On the phone with us this morning is Shay Morris. She's the executive director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank. Hey, Shay, good morning and thanks so much for being with us.
Good morning, Lisa.
So this has got to have been a very trying time for you, and I'm sure that you, perhaps unlike a lot of people, are so very, very conscious of the consumers, the people that need the food that you provide to food shelves and food pantries and shelters. And when you run into bumps and difficulties in getting the food for those programs, that must be particularly hard on you guys because you realize how vulnerable folks can be.
Yes, definitely. This is a critical time.
So let's talk a little bit about how some of these shutdowns and closures have affected you. Second Harvest repurposes food, kind of redirects food that would otherwise be wasted, and makes it available to people through shelter programs, food pantries, food shelves, that kind of thing. Has the restaurant shutdown had any kind of an impact, or has it been more other things at this point?
Yeah, there's a lot of different factors, I will say that. So regionally, you know, we cover northeastern Minnesota and northwestern Wisconsin, so those eight counties around Lake Superior. So much of the product that we're rescuing locally really comes from the retail sector. That's the large majority. So we can talk a little bit about how that's affected us. But really on the other side of it, there's also the, you know, kind of what we'd say, a grouping of different partners that we work with. So, of course, we work with local restaurants. Truth be told, that's about less than 1% of what we normally rescue because restaurants are very efficient and there's not a lot of shrink in that industry. You know, people may have food made to order. There's just not a lot of product. Another sector, though, we've been affected by is the schools. So when schools are closed, UMD, St. Scholastica, Proctor Public School, some of those organizations can also supply food to us. So, again, think about that as probably less than 1%. And then we have a local distributor who provides food to restaurants, you know, that is now not doing that in the same capacity, or to schools or, you know, other institutional partners. So that's another 2%. So added together, you know, that does take a certain amount of product out of the hands of our vulnerable neighbors. So that is concerning when you add them all together. It's probably about 9% total of what we deal with on a day-to-day basis, but it does have impact.
Now, as we're watching the evening news and we're seeing those of us in this part of the world are amazed that, of course, there are parts of the world that are so warm, the country that are so warm and pleasant that folks are already harvesting and there are already crops that they're ready to get to market. But yeah, the supply chains that would get these fresh fruits and vegetables from areas down south and up onto the tables of northern Minnesotans are collapsing, as we're discovering. Talk a little bit about how that works, what the problem is, and what kind of an effect it's having on your work.
Yeah, well, the good news is there's a more recent solution. So on April 17th, you might have seen in the news, there was a $19 billion coronavirus farm assistance program that was put into place. And so that's really going to, you know, it's aimed at really working with regional and local producers, mostly those whose workforce has been impacted by the closure of restaurants or hotels or other food service. But, you know, certainly what that's going to do is going to put additional resources into the hands of farmers. It's going to, you know, I know a lot of people have talked about the milk and how that's being dumped. There's money aimed at rescuing dairy products. So there's some good news in terms of there is a lot of dollars that are now going to be pumped into the USDA commodity program. Second Harvest is one of 200 food banks nationwide who are, you know, mostly a part of that USDA program. So we've been doing this program for years where we're actually, there's the government stipends to purchase product from farmers. We have access to that product. So this is additional funds. And already significantly there have been funds put into this program prior to this with trade mitigation and some other things that have happened. So, you know, we're hoping that these dollars really are enacted fast and we can start moving some of that product, you know, like you said, you aim at the produce, you know, down in the south or the dairy producers, that we can actually get that into the hands of people who need it.
Absolutely. So let's talk about people here in the Northland. You've sent out, of course, a number of communications recently. You've talked about, you quoted somebody from the area that said, I'm very worried about how I'm going to pay for housing, utilities, and food. This person became unemployed as a result of COVID-19. They said, I was always the one people went to for help. Now it's me.
Right. Lots of those stories we're hearing. You know, I can tell you, this is what I know, is that really, you know, the first week, I think, in Wisconsin, Minnesota, when we were going to a shelter in place, all of our regional food shelves felt some form of impact, you know, like increased demand, more people coming, you know. And then we had 2 weeks where it was kind of like, people must be sheltering place, or maybe they're fearful of going to a food shelf. And so numbers were a little bit closer to average, but still high, I would say. This last week, you know, we're thinking, could it be a sign of that, you know, people have been unemployed for a little while and it's starting to impact them? You know, at our own food shelf here at Second Harvest, we had a record increase, or, you know, a record number of people served. We served 523 people in one day. 38% of those were new to us, meaning they hadn't visited a food shelf or our food shelf before. So now we're starting to see probably more of that demand, but it has ebbed and flowed a little bit. We are thinking, though, that, you know, in the long term, we're just going to see more people that are newly unemployed.
How is it for people? I guess I know you, Shay, you're a kind person, you're a respectful person, and I'm assuming that those are values that are all up and down the line for folks that are in this line of work. But what is it like for somebody who maybe hasn't had a ton of money necessarily, but all of a sudden they find themselves in line at a food pantry?
Yeah, it's, you know, certainly not easy. We had an individual who reached out to us and said they were a hairdresser. They had recently become unemployed and they were embarrassed that they had to seek service. And, you know, we reached out to them and said there is absolutely no reason to be embarrassed. This is a time more than ever, if you need food assistance, that you should seek it. Because that's really what we're here for. I mean, this is, especially in crisis, that's when people should turn to us. And I think something interesting to note is that part of that USDA commodity program, so it used to be 180% of the federal poverty guidelines would allow you to qualify for a income need-based program like ours. That's recently been increased to 300%. And when you look at that, what people are trying, or what the USDA commodity program is trying to do is capture people who are newly unemployed. So the first thing is we're looking at a week of your, you know, the most recent week of your income. We're not looking at a lot of long-range data to say, okay, you were once in this position and now you're not. This shows us the data of how recently you've made a certain amount of money, so a week. The second thing is that the 300% of federal poverty guidelines, just to give you an idea, for one person in a household, that threshold now goes up to about $38,000 that you can make and qualify. The other piece of it is for a family of four, that's up to $78,600. So it's a much higher threshold, and that should give people the comfort that, you know what, it might not feel like you have a need, but when you look at that income or you look at where you might be right now, you certainly qualify, and it's a crisis. You know, now is the time, if you need us, to seek us out.
You, a little bit earlier last month, had asked for 10 healthy volunteers to come in and pack boxes. And you've got a bunch of volunteers, but your volunteers are fantastic. But some of them, at least at the beginning, were folks that now are classed, I put this in air quotes because I'm a person of a certain age, I'm putting this in air quotes, are elderly. And so you said, you know, you guys are kind of in a, we want to be really, really careful with you. So you wanted to send them home and you want to get some people to come in and help out. Are you still looking for volunteers?
You know, I will say that we have had amazing support from the region. And because we've had to scale back our volunteer operations, so like you said, you know, we're packing boxes about four times a week. We have four shifts to do that of 10 people in one area. So it's greatly reduced the number of people we can have here. On Tuesdays, we operate a food shelf, and we're probably double that because we have got 10 in different areas. So we've had to scale back our operation to some degree, so we've had a lot of volunteer turnout. And although we're continuing to, you know, respond to people and trying to, like, put, what would I say, rotate people on shifts so everybody gets an opportunity, there's been a great turnout. So I wouldn't say we're feeling like, oh, my gosh, we have no volunteers. And I think we've heard the same from our food shelves. Also, with this curbside distribution we're doing, that requires less people to be involved in a program. I mean, it's a very smooth and quick distribution. People stay in their cars. So right now it feels like the volunteer support has been good.
This is a wonderful opportunity, depending on your circumstance, because you may have time to volunteer now where you never had time to volunteer
right.
before. And if you are receiving services in one way or another and you're uncomfortable about that and you feel like I want to stand on my own two feet, if you can't go to work, there are still places where you can volunteer safely.
Yep.
So contact some of these places that you may have always wanted to be involved with and see if there's something that you can do. Otherwise, you can always, you know, maybe they'll put a pin in your application and hang on to it until
things
get back a little bit closer to normal. So that is excellent to know. If folks are in a position where they can make donations, we've talked at length on this program in the past about how your ability to buy food at discounted prices means that a dollar that would buy us X at the grocery store, you can buy X, Y, Z, and a bunch of numbers at the store. You can go; the dollar can go so much further. What about right now when maybe there are some shortages or things? Are you asking still for folks to support you with cash, or are there actually useful things that they could? Could people share part of their toilet paper stash with you if they
question.
Really wanted to?
Yeah. You know, I think food shelves regionally would certainly accept those type of donations, hand sanitizer. People have been turning out with masks. That's great because we have a lot of volunteers and staff in the front lines. Certainly not the medical masks, just the cloth masks.
Right.
So the one thing I want to clarify is that term of buying food. So Second Harvest depends on donated sources. So that means whether it's General Mills in the Twin Cities and apple produce over in Bayfield, you know, oranges down in Florida, we're accessing donated supplies of food, so there is no buying of that food. There's actually no cost to the food.
Got it.
Our cost is transportation, storage, and handling of that food
wherever
it's donated into our region and back out again. So that's where we can really stretch a dollar. The one thing I did want to talk about is national supplies because you brought that up. So obviously, you know, when shelter in place is going into order, and actually still today, you're hearing about the Smithfield plant. You're hearing about the Hormel plant that have been affected by COVID. And we're seeing real shortages of food. And so what does that do? That makes people panic and overbuy. So before shelter in place, we saw local retail, our donations dropped because people went to the store and they overbought and they brought it home. That leaves a lot of our neighbors who can't and don't have the resources to do that left behind without those sources. So it's really put some impact locally on people, and we have to be aware of that and conscientious. We're all scared, yes, we might not have a food supply, but that's impacted a lot of people. So now that we're seeing that, we went out and said, okay, there's not a lot of donated supply. All of our food banks nationally are scrambling to access donated food, which is short. Now we're going to manufacturing. We're saying, okay, if you have purchased food, this is where we actually do buy product at deep discounts. Can we get a truckload of, you know, canned corn or something like that? And what we do is we bring purchased product into our region to supplement that. That is more expensive than accessing donated food, but right now that's the supply. But again, now we're hearing about other impacts nationally that are happening at manufacturers. And, you know, we're seeing that that's starting to be a shortage too. So I'm hoping this commodity program helps, but certainly, long story short, dollars do help us leverage products that we can get to people, whether donated or purchased. That's the biggest bang for Second Harvest Box, to do that. Because you go to the retail sector, and we have Super One on our board, and I'll say this super nicely, you know, you can go to the grocery store and you can purchase with a dollar your 4 cans of corn. If you give it to us, we can stretch that. And, you know, we certainly want to have the biggest bang for your buck, and we want to be there for our local neighbors.
So if you maybe hoarded a little food, you could consider a donation of that food to a food shelf, a food pantry, a shelter. And then you could also, of course, think about, if it's possible, a financial donation to Second Harvest. Shay, thank you so very, very much for joining us this morning. It is always a treat to talk to you. I appreciate it so much.
Thank you.
We will stay in touch so that we can stay up to speed on this, as in every other factor of our lives. Things change so much week to week, it's kind of hard to know where we'll be and what we'll be talking about next week at this time. So we'll let's stay in touch, Shay. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thanks, Lisa.
Shay Morris is the executive director of Second Harvest Food Bank. She joined us this morning as our guest on Neighbors.
It seems like everything's gone.
Well, oh, the things that we would do if we just had time. We'd clean that closet, we'd renovate that room, we'd get all those photographs off the computer, we'd maybe even, oh my gosh, print some, hang them up on the wall. Who knows what we'd do if we had time? Well, the universe called our bluff, and some folks now have that time. Somebody who's been enjoying, no doubt, the opportunity to go through his photos is photographer Brian Hansel, who joins us on the phone this morning. Hey, Brian, how are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you, Lisa?
Thanks so much for joining us this morning. I realize that we're kind of going way above our pay grade to talk with a celebrated landscape photographer like you, but I, for one, never miss the opportunity to learn from an expert photographer. So you're looking at your computer, you've maybe got all of these images that you've been dumping off your digital camera or maybe downloading off your phone, and you've got no way of knowing where are the pictures of the kids. You have no way of knowing where the pictures are of the new car. You have no way of knowing where anything is. Where do you start?
Well, the first thing that you want to do is figure out what folders you have all your images in, and try to consolidate that into one folder of photos. After you do that, you want to consider backing up all of your photos, because it's
good idea.
One thing that's true in computers is that hard drives will crash.
Boy, and there are people whose hearts have been broken by that loss. And I was lucky that somebody kind of helped me out and I was able to regain some pictures. And then I went right out and spent a little bit of money on some backup.
You know, I teach photography workshops, and that's actually a pretty common question that I get, is how should people back up? And then what I recommend doing, unless you have 3 copies of that file on separate hard drives or online, you don't really have a true backup. So you want your original photo on your hard drive. That's the one that you're going to share out to your friends, to Facebook, to the internet, or whatever. And then you want a copy on a local hard drive that's backed up. I use external hard drives, so I have my main drive of photos backing up to a second external hard drive, and that's done daily. So as I put a new image on the hard drive, it goes to that second one, and then I have an online service that I back up to as well. There's some services out there that aren't very expensive. So if somebody's an Amazon Prime member, they can back up their photos for free at Amazon Prime. So there's a computer program you can download from Prime, and then it finds your photos on your computer and then just backs them up to Amazon Prime's cloud service. And then a service like Backblaze, for the average consumer, it's going to be under $100 a year, and that'll actually back up everything on your computer. So not just your photos, it will do all of your documents and all of your important information.
And of course, I'm guessing that that's adjustable in case you don't want your important information out on the cloud?
Yeah, and it's secure too. So most of the backup services are encrypted. So if somebody came across on the cloud, they wouldn't have the encryption key to be able to get into that information.
So you've taken all of your folders. Some are in the pictures folder, and some are in the photos folder, and some are in the vacation folder, and you've glopped them all together into one big file. Now what do you do?
it's still going to be difficult to figure out which where all your photos are at. So you can't, unless you do this thing called keywording, you can't just go to your computer and type in, you know, Uncle Joan's wedding party or something like that. So the next step is to start keywording all of your photos, and you're going to want a program to do that. So what I use is Adobe Lightroom, which is a subscription product from Adobe. You can edit all your photos in there, but you can also keyword everything. And when you keyword it all, you can just go and type in, you know, sunrise, Lake Superior, Grand Marais Lighthouse, and then all my sunrise pictures of the Grand Marais Lighthouse will pop up.
I've discovered for myself with keywording that it's the kind of thing that you should be disciplined enough to do on a regular basis. With some services, you can do kind of a batch keywording too, can't you, where you can select all of the pictures that you took at the wedding and keyword that entire group, Uncle Joan's wedding.
Yep. So most of the programs allow you to do that batch keywording right at import. So when you import it on your computer, you can type out wherever you were at. The way that I like to do it is put the state that I'm in, the city that I'm near, the location, sunrise or sunset, because I'm usually shooting sunrise or sunset, and then any prominent feature. So I live in Grand Marais, so I shoot Artist Point a lot. So I would type, if I was out this morning shooting on Artist Point, I would type in Grand Marais, Minnesota, Artist Point, sunrise, early spring. And then if it's a picture of like the basalt rock, I might type in basalt bar rock. If there's a wave pool, I would type that in. Just as much information as you could possibly type in makes it easier for you in the future to be able to find those images quickly.
The other thing that I have found that's helpful when you're thinking about keywording is, remember the last time you were upset and you said, why can't I find any pictures of the kids in the swimming pool? And that's how you know what keywords to use. Kids, swimming pool. So you think about, how am I looking for photographs? What is it that I'm looking for? Was I looking for a vacation? Was I looking for that trip to North Dakota? What exactly am I looking for in the photographs? Is I looking for a picture of my dad or my mom or my kids, and which kid? And if you have an idea how you're looking for things and what you've been looking for that you can't find, that'll also give you kind of a helpful way to start with your photographs. Oh, here's a question that we just received. How to keep digital photos accessible over time as data formats and computer cables change? I had an old external hard drive that would not connect to my computer. Luckily, I was able to find a connecting cord that I was able to order secondhand in the nick of time. The caller had a question about photos that are trapped in an old Apple.
Yeah, that's a difficult thing. So as technology changes, we have to migrate our photos to the newer formats. So what I suggest doing is about every 2 to 3 years, get a new hard drive and take all of your photos off of your old hard drive, move them to the new one. As far as file formats, we've been pretty lucky that the file formats are generally stable. And Adobe, which is the one that most professional photographers use, the Adobe programs will read digital files all the way back to the beginning of digital cameras and before that. So that's, the file format's not as big issue as far as much as the technology is, because the hard drive formats, the cables, that all changes. So you constantly have to be migrating to the new system. Having an online backup alleviates that a little bit, because you can always get those files out of the cloud if you need them. So if your hard drive dies or changes format, you can pull that down and put it all on a different hard drive.
Excellent. Excellent tip for that. And I would imagine that whenever you've got anything trapped on an old computer, most of the time that's a question for your local computer tech person to say, can you please go inside and save this for me? And then they do magic. They do some chanting and some waving of hands, and poof, there are your folders, usually your files, usually. Not always, but usually. So, by the way, just want to mention 218-726-7181. If you've got a phone call for Brian, and if you have a question or a comment that you want to make about organizing your photographs, what about what should I do with my photographs. As a fledgling photographer, as a newbie, every so often I take a photograph that I'm really pleased with and I'm proud of it and I feel like I can see that I've made progress and I look at it and it makes me happy. But I'm not always sure what to do with it. I mean, I never see it if it sits on my computer, but what are some options for what you can do with your photos? The old photo albums that we used to have were so wonderful to just sit and while away hours with, looking at the people that you love.
Yeah, you can still get prints made, which I actually think is a great option because for me, the ultimate goal of photography is to eventually see my images in print somewhere, either a magazine or a print that I make myself and sell to somebody. And it's very rewarding to see that in physical format instead of digital format. You know, if you have, there's a bunch of online services that you can use if you don't have a printer at home, and it's not actually a great idea for the average user to invest in a printer because they're kind of expensive, and if you're only going to print 10, 15 photos a year, it's just a lot easier to do it online.
Oh, and they're so inexpensive locally. I mean, you know, maybe a 4x6 print sometimes are like 9 cents a piece, and you're not going to be able to do that at home.
Yeah, no doubt. So the inkjet inks are pretty expensive. So when you can get it 9-10 cents a photo online, it works better. So there's a lot of local labs that you can use for that. So I know down in Duluth, there's like First Photo that has a lab capacity there. But online, if your listeners want a good online location, there's one called MPIX. So that's MPIX.com. That's a really consumer-friendly site that's easy to use.
I've also used another one. I don't know whether we're supposed to be giving brand names necessarily, but I have used another one that allows you to put photos on different objects. I just had a bunch of fleece blankets made for friends with photos on them, and those were a really big hit. And, you know, coffee mugs and calendars and that sort of stuff. So you don't always have to have necessarily just a plain print. You could put something on a keychain or a cell phone cover, for example.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of that. I haven't actually done a lot of that myself, but I've seen some of those blankets, and they're really neat, especially for gift ideas. So if somebody wants a gift idea, they could put pictures of their family on one of those blankets and send it to grandma or whatever. It'd be a very comforting gift.
Yeah, I ended up putting, for one friend, all of her dogs that I'd managed to photograph over the years, and for another friend, some photographs I'd taken of their dog, and they lost him earlier this year, and they were really happy to have that. And it's a nice, snuggly way to be surrounded by the people and the things that you love the best.
I like the coffee mug idea, too. So
like a Grand Marais sunrise. Too. Wouldn't a Grand Marais sunrise be nice either on a blanket or a coffee mug or both?
Yeah, it would.
You get up in the morning and you go out and you look at the sunrise and you wrap your blanket around your shoulders and you have a little sip out of your coffee mug and go, wow.
Yeah, you could feel like you're taking a little vacation right there in your house.
What a fabulous, fabulous way of keeping a vacation or some of those memories of people and things that are special to you handy, because that's why we take the pictures to begin with. Brian, thank you so very much for joining us this morning. What a treat to have you along with us. It was great, and I hope we have the opportunity to talk again soon.
All right. Thanks a lot, Lisa.
Brian Hansel is the owner of Brian Hansel Photography. You can find him, of course, online. Shay Morris joined us also this morning. She is the executive director of Second Harvest Northern Lakes Food Bank. They also have a website. We'll get that up so that folks can get more information there. This is Neighbors on 103.3 KUMD. KUMD program on Tuesdays and Thursdays to do a little bit of idea sharing. Talk about what we're dealing with, talk about some solutions that perhaps we've thought up, and generally just support one another through these ever so challenging times.